Good morning, everyone. Monday, July 27th, the start of another week of war. To bring you news of that war, NBC turns now to members of its foreign and domestic staffs, trained radio reporters stationed in all the world's key cities. First to Cairo for the report of Grant Parr.
Hello, New York. This is Grant Parr speaking from Cairo, Egypt. The lull on the Alamein front seems to be a third and dormant phase in the battle for Egypt. This inactive period is now entering its fifth day. But when the next flare-up comes, it is likely to mean heavy fighting on a large and possibly decisive scale. For this is a period of extensive preparation on both sides. The first phase of the Battle of Alamein, or the Battle of Egypt, was the all-out German attack on British defenses. It failed miserably, and the Germans themselves had to take the defenses. The British then began a series of attacks, large and small, which looped the front in a tight pocket around the Nazis. But it did not break the German line. Both sides thus have shown much strength defensively. The Germans are determined not to retreat and made wide and effective use of minefields and anti-tank batteries. The Nazis are not yet able to resume the offensive. But if they do, they will again meet barriers similar to those which stopped them before. Which brings us back again to the old race for reinforcements. And that means the Italian merchant fleet versus the Royal Air Force. And American industry versus the shipping bottleneck. Saturday night, heavy four-engine bombers of the United States Army Air Force carried out their most successful raid since the bombing of the Italian fleet with which their Middle East operations began. This time the target was Tobruk Harbor. As the bombs rained down, oil dumps exploded and flames, going into a veritable holocaust, spread through the harbor area. One of the best achievements was the bombing of a pipeline used to carry petroleum from ships in the harbor two-storage tank. First Lieutenant Mark Muti of Winter Haven, Florida, jockeyed his huge airplane over the pipeline, and Bombardier navigator First Lieutenant Ernest Duckworth of Providence, Rhode Island, cut loose a stick of bomb. The first thing they saw afterward was a long, livid line of fire that lashed savagely across the darkness below them. It spread with incredible speed, and the raider dropped more bombs until the whole area was lit up with blazing oil. Last night, the Royal Air Force bombed Tobruk
and blew up an ammunition ship.
And now to turn you to New York.
In the British capital, where it is after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, John McVane is waiting to report. Go ahead, London.
This is London. London had 2 air raid alarms early this morning. Some people said they heard a plane and a little anti-aircraft fire in one part of the capital. Later, we learned that about 30 German planes, flying singly in low cloud, came inland between 6 and 9 o'clock to carry out the most widespread attacks on England in a long time. They dropped bombs at several places and caused casualties and damage. It's thought that the casualties weren't heavy at any one point. 50 killed and 50 injured is one estimate, and property damage is described as extensive. The raiders made their chief attacks against 5 places on the east coast of England and 4 Midland towns. Several trains were machine gunned. RAF bombers last night made a heavy attack on Hamburg. They had good weather, and preliminary reports say the raid was very successful. The Germans this morning admitted that numerous fires caused material damage. 29 British bombers are missing, but the raid is thought to have been the largest since the last 1,000 bomber attack, so the percentage isn't dangerously high. Hamburg is the biggest seaport on the continent of Europe and produces more submarines than any other center in Germany. The announcement that American Army pilots took part in yesterday's fighter sweeps over France indicates that American flyers are being worked gradually into combat shape. One British commentator today says the American flyers have shown themselves to be keen, quick-witted war pilots, and he says their flexibility and quick reactions are perfect combinations for this high-speed work. British correspondents in America are saying that many Americans have the idea that we're going to win the war soon by heavy air raids on Germany. To an observer here, this seems over-optimistic. There are some factors that should be remembered. First, the Germans bombed Britain hard from nearby airfields in the continent for a period of about 10 months. They didn't even come close to winning the war. Second, weather in Europe is often too bad for flying. It's no good sending over 1,000 bombers if you're going to lose 200 or 300 from bad weather accidents. In a period of about 2 months, there have been 3,000 bomber raids against Germany. 3 in the first month and none in the second. This would indicate that a 1,000 bomber raid is a big effort for the RAF at the moment. It's twice as large as the biggest effort the Luftwaffe was ever able to put forth here. As far as official announcements go, the American air effort so far in this theater has been a raid of 6 bombers and another of 7 fighter pilots. That only means that setting up a big American air striking force is a complicated job. When it does go into action, the size and frequency of big raids on Germany will increase. But to talk of a second front in the air now is just playing on words. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
So far, we have brought you the report of Grant Parr in Cairo and John McVane in London. And now to the Southwest Pacific to hear from one of NBC's staff covering events in Australia.
This is Martin Agronsky somewhere in Australia. Yesterday, at Awala, a point some 25 miles inland from Gona Mission on the Papuan coast, and along a wild mountain track through the Owen Stanley Range, our advance patrols made their first land contact with the enemy since the Japs began landing at Gona last Tuesday night. It was only a light skirmishing action, but the Jap is moving back to Papua, and there seems to be little doubt now that the Gona landing is a starting point for an overland attack against Moresby. Since our heavy bombing attacks prevented a Jap convoy carrying reinforcements to Gona from landing 3 days ago, there is no further indication that the enemy has tried to send troops or supplies by sea to his new Papuan base. Since today's communique also reports that our troops killed 60 Japs while successfully repulsing a recent attack on Mubo, which lies in New Guinea north of Gona and only some 12 miles south of Salamoa, it can be assumed that we have a force capable of attacking any Jap forces which may be sent overland to reinforce the Gona garrison. Generally, news of our land forces having been in action at Awala between Gona and Fort Moresby and at Mubo between Gona and Salamoa is encouraging. While it may not signify imminent land attacks on the enemy on a large scale, it at least prevents the Jap and the New Guinea and Papuan area from moving freely without considerable land forces. The delay, this at least temporary restriction on his land movements may cause the enemy, could conceivably enable our forces to plug the mountain road from Gona to Moresby with enough troops to stop cold a Jap overland attack on Moresby. Should our Air Force, which throughout yesterday again hit the Japs at Gona with everything they had, be equally successful, first, in preventing the Japs already landed from consolidating their position, and second, in preventing seaborne reinforcements from reaching Gona, we should have a fighting chance of neutralizing the Gona invasion attempt and eventually of driving the Japs out of Papua. Though the Japs undoubtedly stole a march on us at Gona, the only really unhappy comment that must be made about our position on this front today remains this, that anyone can still entertain a question about our ability after 7 months of war in the Southwest Pacific to undertake even such small operations against the mortal Japanese enemy. This is Martin Agronsky signing off now from somewhere in Australia.
Richard Harkness of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Washington Bureau covers events at home, speaking from our nation's capital.
The country has been looking to Washington the last month for word on a second front. But what few people realize is this. Our Navy is fighting on a second front. It's engaged on a second front that Hitler has opened right here on our own doorstep. I mean submarine sinkings off the Atlantic coast. The latest victim was a Canadian fishing schooner. She makes a total of 399 ships lost since Pearl Harbor. Now, only the Navy knows our losses in shipping tonnage or our losses in terms of war cargoes. But I can tell you this much. Navy officers are convinced that Hitler is sinking our ships with a new and secret type of giant U-boat. They can cruise 12,000 miles, enough to come here from German bases in France, stay on our side of the ocean for a month or more, and get home again without refueling. Representative Lyndon Johnson isn't satisfied with the high command of the Navy, or the Army either, for that matter. The Texas Democrat is demanding the removal of certain admirals and generals he charges are indecisive, stupid, selfish, and incompetent. Now, this isn't any politician talking. Johnson just came back from 4 months of active service with the Navy, so he's seen our military command in action with his own eyes. Our fighting men are better than the Japs, he says, but he insists we've got to get rid of the deadwood at top. There are other indications that Congress isn't satisfied with the war. Senators Johnson and Lee will introduce a resolution this noon calling for a formal investigation of the possibility of using big cargo planes, planes big enough to carry our fighting men and material to the battlefronts all over the world. The Truman Defense Investigation Committee already is planning to go into this matter. And over on the House side of the Capitol, members of the House Merchant Marine Committee say they're going to find out who's to blame for our present steel shortage. Meanwhile, at home, it becomes increasingly clear what sacrifices all of us must make to win this war. Donald Nelson tells us that he has sent two experts to London to study how the British have cut civilian production to the bone. Now, the announcement of the war production boss means only one thing. Before long, all our clothes may be made of what the British call a utility design. And all our dishes, our pencils, and even our chocolate candy and everything else may be limited to certain types. And we'll know more about the tax bill before this day is over. The Senate Finance Committee is meeting an executive session this afternoon to decide whether we'll have a sales tax. And that's all from Washington.
And that was Richard Harkness of the Philadelphia Inquirer's Washington Bureau reporting from Washington. A first-hand account of the battles along the Russian front comes to us now via shortwave from Robert Magadoff in Moscow.
This is Robert Magadoff speaking from Moscow. The battle for the Northern Caucasus has reached a still graver stage. The Germans have broken through at yet another sector in the suburbs of Rostov, the capital of the Northern Caucasus, and are pressing on in spite of heavy losses. Further east in the Semlyanskaya region, the enemy has widened the area under his control on the northern bank of the Don and is trying to establish bridgeheads at a number of places simultaneously. Along with this, the Don is swarming with German rubber boats and rafts. Reckless disregard for losses has already allowed the enemy to concentrate considerable tank and infantry forces also on the southern bank of the Don. The fate of the Northern Caucasus, rich in grain and oil, is being decided in the present Don River battle, but the eyes of the Soviet nation are glued not only to that part of the world. The Russians look also westward, with hope and expectation. They are waiting for a second front. They are still full of fight and mean to fight on to the last, but they realize the dangers facing them and are wondering whether the Yanks and the Tommies are coming. Not wishing to interfere with the plans of their allies, the Soviet officials as well as the press are silent on the subject, but the people aren't. They talk, think, and dream the second front. Last night, when I suggested to a Russian friend of mine that the Allied armies might not be fully ready yet for the enormous task of establishing a second front, he argued back rather heatedly. But don't you see that Hitler has thrown everything he's got against us? With fewer men and less preparation right now, you can achieve much more than with greater numbers and more elaborate preparations later on. Goodbye from Moscow.
And so ends this morning's roundup of the news with reports from Grant Parr in Cairo, John McVane in London, Richard Harkness in Washington, Martin Agronsky in Australia, and Robert Magadoff in Moscow. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.